warm welcome to all Red Ice Creations members. Thank you for being here and thank you for tuning in. We are continuing our fascinating discussion with John Lash, author of Not in His Image. And we want to change gear, I guess, a little bit in the subscriber section and talk a little bit more about the idea of what John calls Gnostic theory of alien intrusion, and connect this with the Archons, of course. The Archons is a subject that I've been fascinated by for a long time. And John, maybe we could actually start with a definition of that word itself. There seems to be a lot of different interpretations of it out there. Seems to be some kind of, you know, almost dispute or confusion where the term actually comes from and what it means. What's your take on the term the Archons?
Well, there are two ways to define the term, and you're absolutely right, Henrik. Even before we talk about it, it's very, very important to present as clear a definition of this term in the as Gnostics understood it as possible, because it's a profoundly important term in the Gnostic teachings, and it leads us into some really profound areas. In the first place, the word archon is a Greek word that was very common back in the days of Jesus Christ, back in 2,000 years ago, and it simply meant governor, or like the governor of a province was the archon.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what it meant in Greek, in a mundane sense. But there are two ways to understand the word archon if you want to approach it as the Gnostics did. In the first place, the archons, an archon is a being that appears in the Gnostic creation myth. The Gnostics took this word archon out of its mundane context and they used it to describe a certain kind of cosmic entity. You see, the Gnostics had a creation myth, and this is the story of the divine Sophia, a goddess who turned into the earth. Now, on MetaHistory.org, you'll find a lot about this story, and I've told this story in nine episodes. I also tell it in my book in nine episodes. In a sense, I reconstructed this myth.
Mm.
In this myth, which is too long to go into here, there is an episode where the archons appear in the cosmic order. And they are called archons because the word comes from the Greek root arche, which means first or in the beginning.
Mm.
And so what the Gnostics meant was that when our solar system was forming, before the Earth itself actually took the form it has today, certain beings appeared in our solar system before the Earth was formed. That's why they're called archons. They came first. And these beings are kind of described as an inorganic species. And they inhabit the solar system, but they do not inhabit the Earth. So that's how the archons are described in the Gnostic mythology. If you go to the myth and read the myth and study the myth, which is absolutely fascinating, and it's a unique myth. The second part of the definition, which I think might be helpful, is this. The archons, who are also scholars translate the word as rulers or authorities.
Mm, yeah.
The archons play a great role in the Nag Hammadi materials. I would say that of the surviving Nag Hammadi materials, the Coptic materials, maybe 20% or better of the texts deal with these entities.
Hmm.
And they not only describe them in the cosmic sense, how they emerged at the creation of our solar system before the Earth was formed, as I just described, but they also describe them in another very disturbing way. There are passages in certain Gnostic texts which resemble 100% close encounters with extraterrestrial beings.
Hmm.
And I've quoted these on the MetaHistory site, and there's a great deal of material about this on the MetaHistory site. And so the second part of the definition, this is very important, this is drawn directly from the Coptic texts. Archons are extraterrestrial entities, and they are like psychic intruders. They intrude upon humanity, they intrude upon the human race. But because they can't invade the Earth as such, because they cannot live in the biosphere of the Earth.
Hmm.
They live in the solar system. They are inorganic beings. But because they cannot invade the Earth, they tend to invade our minds. They are entities that can reach us, you might say, interdimensionally,
mm-hmm.
or through a psychic and telepathic level. And all this is described quite vividly in the Gnostic materials. And so it's quite remarkable if you make the parallel with gray ETs and close encounters. If you want to make that parallel, I think there's a great deal of evidence that that is a good parallel, and it's a convincing parallel, and I've written about that a great deal, as you know.
That's absolutely fascinating. I'm so intrigued by that idea. Let's go into that a little bit later. I want to ask you first, though, are there kind of any definition in the text of what the Archons kind of are doing, what their purpose or what their goals are? Why are they just around the planet Earth or everywhere in the universe? Is there any kind of definition of that?
Yes, there is amazingly precise definitions of this, really. And I think that if I would speak of my own work as a scholar and my attempt to make Gnostic writings, you know, accessible to people and to make them understandable, this is one of the most important points that I have worked on.
Hmm.
You know, no other scholar, you know, I'm a self-taught scholar. I don't work with a university or anything. I'm responsible to no one but myself.
Sure.
And I'm responsible to my sense of the truth. Okay?
Yep.
Well, no other scholar dares to say anything about this Archon material. You can take a book, the most famous book about Gnosticism is the Gnostic Gospels by Elaine Pagels.
Mm-hmm.
It was published, I think, 24 years ago. It's still in print, widely read. The word Archon is not in the index.
Really?
Yeah. Even though it's obvious from reading the text that the Archons were a deep concern for the Gnostics, scholars will not have anything to do with this because it freaks them out. And it also looks very much like parapsychology and, you know, UFO ET material.
Sure.
And, of course, as scholars, they wouldn't dare touch that because it would completely ruin their reputation.
That's unfortunately right.
That's unfortunately the case. So now I'm going to answer your question. It is remarkable that we find in the Nag Hammadi text an explicit description not only of the origin of these extraterrestrial archons, but of their purposes, of the way they operate, of their methods, and of their tactics in regard to the human species. It's remarkable. And there are a couple of points that I would just make, and then we'll explore it more based on your questions. One of the things, the Gnostic materials warn us about these entities. There's a clear warning that these entities endanger the human species because they can lead us astray from our proper course of evolution. They're deviant. They can deviate us, and they do this in two ways. One is through the factor of what is called error, or plane in Greek. Plane, by the way, is the root of the word planet. So error is one of the ways that the Archons mislead us, and that is when we are beings who need to think and plan things in advance. That is the nature of our species. We stand out from other animals because we have planning abilities. We can make models, and then we can follow those models, and we can actually create things from those models,
right?
Which other species cannot do. And the Gnostics warned that when we make mistakes in that process, if we do not correct those mistakes, the Archons will enter our minds, and they will use those mistakes to steer us away from the Earth and to steer us away from our true path. So they warned about error. They called them messengers of error. The second thing they warned about very explicitly is they said that the primary capacity of the Archons is something called Hal, H-A-L.
Really?
H-A-L is a Coptic word. And what it means is simulation. Simulation or artifice. Or you could say virtual reality. An example of Hal is plastic and pearl. suppose I put a white round object in your hand and I say to you, that's a pearl. Well, we know that a pearl is made by nature.
Mm-hmm.
It's made under the sea in the body of an oyster. Human beings cannot do that. It's done by nature.
Sure.
But suppose I say, this is a pearl in your hand, when actually it's just a ball of plastic that looks like a pearl.
Mm-hmm.
Now, suppose that you were incapable of telling the pearl from the plastic.
Mm-hmm.
That would be hal. That would be simulation. And one of the things that the Gnostics warned about is that there's a tendency in our own mind to become infatuated with our models, our fictions, and our simulations. And the more that we do that, in a sense, the more we allow these archons to take over our minds.
Hmm.
It's a very sophisticated analysis, and it's a very, very strong warning.
Hmm. Absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
So, in regards to the text, again, going back, do you think that, or rather, do you know how could the Gnostics back then known of their existence? Is there any hint of that, meaning that was this something they discovered while they were in prayer or some kind of meditation, or was this something they have just been aware of because of their ancestors have been passing down information? Any clues on that?
How could the Gnostics know of the existence of these entities? How could they know how they came into existence in the first place?
Yeah.
How could the Gnostics know about how our solar system was created? How could they know what the techniques and the tactics of the archons are? I pondered those questions very seriously. Now, you will not find in the texts themselves a direct answer to those questions, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't mislead you on that. But I have an answer, and I feel confident about it. But I must tell you that my answer is from an inference.
Mm.
Okay?
Mm.
I'm just making an inference.
Sure.
This is John Lash's inference, and you can take it or leave it. This is what he thinks. He thinks that the Gnostic schools of the mysteries, which existed up until the Christian time, were actually the inheritors of many thousands of years of spiritual and shamanic practice. The Gnostics were shamans, and they inherited from their ancestors in Europe, in Scandinavia, from the great traditions of the great seers like Odin.
Mm.
Odin would be a typical example of an ancient Gnostic, an ancient shaman.
Mm.
And so Gnosticism is the flower of indigenous European shamanism. And if this is true, then I would infer that Gnostics were parapsychologists, that they could experience alternative realities, that they could explore the astral world, they could explore other worlds, and in the process of their shamanism and their practice of heightened awareness, they detected these entities directly. They encountered these entities. They looked into the history of the solar system, call it what you will, reading the Akashic Record, call it whatever you want.
Mm.
We know today that shamans in indigenous cultures in the Amazon and elsewhere have these faculties.
That's
and
right.
Shamans from, say, the ayahuasca shamans of Peru and the Amazon, and shamans in other cultures around the world, in Africa, for instance, report the same information about these entities. So when you ask me how they know, I say to you, they were accomplished shamans who had faculties of higher perception that allowed them to experience these things directly.
Hmm.
That is my view.
Very interesting. Do you think that it could be possible that at the same time they had, I mean, there are so many stories of when, for example, many of the South American tribes are entering into this other world, so to speak, that they have contact with other forms of entities that actually hands down information to them, something about what is happening on Earth or their own health in some cases. There are so many stories about this.
Indeed.
Do you think that
could
be... And
in fact, there is textual evidence for that.
Sure.
There are about, I think, three or four of the Nag Hammadi texts that present themselves as what we would today call documents of channeling.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Sure.
Channeling. And in those texts, we have a report, as it were, a kind of shorthand report. It's not the reports are kind of, like notes taken in a classroom, And the report seems to indicate that there is a master or a seer or shaman who is standing in front of the group of students and is communicating with a higher dimensional being and channeling information from that being. And there are texts which actually show that, one of which is called the Discourse on the Eighth and the Ninth. The Discourse on the Eighth and the Ninth is a Nag Hammadi text that actually describes that kind of channeling session. And so you're absolutely right. Some of the information that Gnostics received came from contacting higher intelligences, and it's clear from the text that they discerned and detected many different kinds of non-human entities in the cosmos. And not all of them were hostile to humanity. In fact, many of them were allies.
Right.
But they did detect one predatory species, the Archons. And one is all it takes, man.
Sure, that's right.
One is all it takes.
Yeah.
It's like the malaria. It's like malaria. It only takes one mosquito, an Anopheles mosquito, to bite you to give you malaria.
Sure.
There are many mosquitoes in the world, many kinds of instincts, but it only takes one. And so they seemed to have been terribly concerned that there was one predatory species, the Archons, that we really need to watch out for.
And it even might be very difficult going into this other place and discern who's who, so to speak, who's hostile, who's not, who's deceiving, who's giving me right information here. That must always be a concern, right?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. There was a book that came out in 1980 called The Way of the Shaman by Michael Harner. And this was a key book in bringing shamanism into the mainstream. And Michael Harner was a psychiatrist from Connecticut or somewhere in the East Coast who went to South America and, you know, did ayahuasca. And under the ayahuasca trance, he had a vision and so forth, and he saw various things. And, of course, the session of ayahuasca he did was controlled or managed by some of the veteran ayahuasca shamans who were in that region.
Right.
And Michael Harner relates this amazing incident of how he came out of his ayahuasca vision and he turned to the old Brazilian shaman there to tell him what he'd experienced, you know. And he said, oh, I met these dragon-like beings and they had wings and they said that they came to the earth in a boat and they brought the seeds of humanity here in this boat, in this big canoe and so forth and so on. And isn't that fascinating? Now I know how humanity originated. And the old Brazilian shaman looked at him and laughed.
Yeah.
And he said, well, they always tell everybody that. They're just a bunch of liars, you know. And so the interesting thing is that if you're going to practice shamanism and you're going to go into altered states of consciousness, you must learn how to distinguish the trick, how to see what the tricksters are doing, because there are many tricksters out there.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And you must, it's part of the practice of knowing the true from the false.
Yeah.
Just like in any other field of life, you know.
Of course.
So I believe that the Gnostics were highly accomplished shamans who could detect the difference and that they pinpointed these Archons as a particular menace to us.
Absolutely fascinating. Now let's dive into a little bit about, well, I guess I want to start at 1947 and move on from there. I want to talk about Roswell. I want to talk
Roswell.
About Roswell, exactly, the discovery.
Roswell, New Mexico, right.
Yeah, and the discovery of the Nag Hammadi Library in the similar time period. We could talk about the OSS becoming the CIA, you know, how
that's right.
Transpired. There's so much there. Where do you want to begin?
Well, I think, you know, there's a piece on that on the site, of course, 1947 Nexus. I think that it's fascinating. We could talk about that for the rest of the night. Just point out the essential facts. I'll just point this out for those of your listeners who don't know. The Nag Hammadi texts were discovered actually by an Arab peasant in December 1945, but their importance was not recognized. They were just stuffed in a drawer in a museum in Cairo. And it was not until June 1947 when another scholar came from France, Jean Dorès came from France, and that he was shown these and he realized how important they were. Now, June, July, August of 1947 was a time when simultaneously a number of other events occurred. That was also the year that the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. And so, and the Dead Sea Scrolls are another kind of document. They were discovered near Jerusalem, and they were written in Hebrew and Aramaic. Mm-hmm. But they form an important part of this story. The Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. The CIA was founded from the OSS, and a whole number of other things occurred in 1947. It was sort of like an explosion of the human psyche. We're kind of living in the effects of that explosion now. And the main effect of that is that these esoteric religious documents, the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi documents, are somehow all mixed up with our ideas of global conspiracy and our ideas of extraterrestrial, extraterrestrial influence.
Sure.
Yeah. It's just remarkable.
Yeah.
Just a little over 60 years ago, that it all seemed to explode at the same moment.
It did. You already have kind of laid out the idea that the Archons possibly could either be the Grace or have some kind of a relationship to them, and I want to explore that further, and I want to explore the idea of alien technology further, and what is happening with us now. I guess the first thing I would like to ask you is, do you think that possibly then there was a downed craft, so to speak, a craft that crashed in Roswell around 47,
right,
and a consequence of that was that we attained some kind of alien technology?
Right, right. The Roswell crash, which took place also in that year, is significant because the Roswell crash is the basis of what is called the extraterrestrial hypothesis.
Mm.
If you look on MetaHistory.org, you'll find in the site guide, there's an article called 9 Theories of Extraterrestrial Influence.
Mm.
There are 9, and I outline 9 different theories. One of those theories is the Gnostic theory, which I've been discussing with you.
Mm.
But the most well-known one, of course, is the so-called extraterrestrial hypothesis. And according to this hypothesis, an alien spacecraft crashed in Roswell in 1947, and bodies were recovered, living bodies. And what happened is that the American government secretly cut a deal with these gray aliens and got from them technology, secrets of technology, in return for allowing them to experiment on the human race, to abduct people, to interbreed, and so forth and so on.
Mm.
Okay?
Mm.
That's the extraterrestrial hypothesis, which is the most widely accepted conspiracy theory. Now, you're asking me, do I think that that crash actually took place? Well, I want to say this, that in the Gnostic materials that I've studied, there are descriptions of close encounters,
mm-hmm,
of abductions,
mm-hmm,
vivid descriptions. And there are also descriptions of the gray-type aliens and a reptilian-type alien.
Really?
Those are in the text.
Huh.
But I must add that there are no descriptions of hardware. There are no descriptions of flying saucers in the Gnostic material.
Mm-hmm.
So I tend to be very, very cautious when I hear claims that there's actually hardware that it has, crashed and so forth. There are descriptions of hardware and flying saucers in the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Mm-hmm.
So these sightings have occurred from very ancient times. So my answer would be, I really don't know. I tend to think that the Roswell story may have been largely invented and that it may be being used to manipulate people. It's a very complex subject, but
sure.
I kind of follow Jacques Vallée on this.
Oh.
Jacques Vallée, who wrote Messengers of Deception.
Mm.
He was, in my opinion, the most intelligent and careful analyst of the UFO phenomena.
Mm.
And he says whether or not alien spacecraft have actually crashed, the story about them controls people's minds and manipulates people.
Hmm.
And I sort of take that view.
Mm. Well,
sorry if it sounds like I'm weaseling out of the question.
No. That's a perfect one, because I also want to kind of go into that area a little bit. That if, because earlier you said that these archons are kind of a, you know, not physical, so to speak. This is something otherworldly that can't occupy bodies. But what I kind of want to lead into here a little bit is the fact that they actually are interested in inhabiting bodies on this planet, meaning that they want to in some way either incarnate into bodies or actually build something either from genetic material or from mechanic, you know, robotics basically, that they can incarnate into. One idea that has been laid forth is the idea that the Greys actually are robots. If we think of the idea of how we do things now,
that's right.
Meaning that we send probes, we send robots into space to explore other planets.
That's right.
So why could not the Greys be a more, you know, artificial intelligence, almost kind of a entity in itself, coming here exploring on behalf on some other intelligence from another solar system, you know?
Okay. Now, there are, of course, thousands and thousands of theories about this, and there's a lot of confusion about it. Let me see if I can give you, as briefly as possible, a Gnostic approach that may be helpful.
Sure.
What I draw from what the Gnostics said about the Archons are two important points. The first point is that they are an inorganic species, you know, probably silicon, mercury kind of base, and that they live in the solar system at large, but they cannot live in the biosphere of the Earth. So there, for them to come into the biosphere of the Earth is more or less like a human being diving into the bottom of the ocean. We need to have very complicated diving gear. We need to either go in a diving bell, or we have to have some kind of bulky diving equipment.
Mm-hmm.
But we cannot stay down at the bottom of the ocean very long, because we're not designed to live there. So this explains why the actual physical appearances of these aliens would be so erratic and so brief. Because they're only able to make brief forays into our atmosphere. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's one explanation. The second point is even more important. You raise the question, well, do they want to incarnate? Do they want to somehow become embodied on Earth and take over the Earth? Well, from what I draw from the Gnostic writings, this is not their aim. Their aim is more or less to invade our minds and to live through us. Now, if they succeed in doing that, then we would become archontic.
Mm-hmm.
I use that adjective,
mm-hmm.
archontic.
Sure.
What does it mean to become archontic? If the human race were to become archontic, we would show a change of behavior that would be dramatic. First of all, we would only live in simulated or artificial environments. We would sever all connections with the natural world. Second, if the human race were to become archontic, we would make ourselves into robots. We would become robotized in our behavior. We would become like robots, like robot zombies. And we would attempt to do everything to replace our natural organs with prosthetic organs. We would, for instance, if we had a perfectly natural legs, we would prefer to replace those legs with robotic legs.
Bionic, yeah.
Bionic. We would become bionic. We would go into a bionic phase. That is how we would behave if what the Gnostics warned is true. The Archons primarily are mind parasites. They don't have the capacity, really, to incarnate as human beings, but they have the capacity to go so deeply into our minds that we can try to become them. They make us try to become like they are. That's how I understand what they would do. And I see many indications of us going in that direction the current technology, in nanotechnology, bionics, and those things that you are looking at, you know, on your site.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And I mean, there are so many points there that I want to pick up on, but one thing at a time here. There, the reason for them, for, you know, changing us, so to speak, for going
right.
first into our minds and then changing our bodies, which consequently also reflects our minds, so we would change our own mentality.
Exactly.
Would that, the interest from the Archons, do you think that that is for, what is their own purposes for you, or do they want to use us for something? You know, is there a galactic war going on? What's
no,
happening?
No, I have to tell you, this is, what I'm going to tell you now is extremely weird, but I am not making it up. What I'm going to tell you now is my best expression of what I have found in the Gnostic writings.
Mm.
The first point is absolutely clear. The Gnostics say that the motivation of the Archons is envy.
Hmm.
They use that word envy, thonos in Greek. They say that the Archons envy us because we're kind of like a cousin species to them. But we are the privileged cousins because we live in a paradise, which is the Earth and the biosphere. And they live out in the solar system at large, and they have hardware, I'm sure they do, and they move around among the various planets, and they have space stations among the various planets, and as you know, there's been quite a bit of confirmation of this since NASA has been out there poking around.
Mm.
Okay?
Mm.
But they envy us because we live in an actual paradise. We live in a place that is sensual, in a place that is beautiful, in a place that is sheltered from the rest of the universe. And so the first thing that they teach us about them is that they envy us.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing they say is really mind-boggling. They say that the Gnostics, that the Archons operate in a senseless manner, that they have no real plan, that they are just senselessly disrupting us. And they get a certain satisfaction out of doing that. They get a satisfaction out of, they get kind of a vicarious thrill when we are fearful and confused. The intensity of the emotion of fear and the intensity of confusion seems in a way to feed them.
Hmm.
And so in the final analysis, and I know this is not an easy thing to accept, but I'm giving you my best, you know, my best research here.
Sure.
In the final analysis, they're tricksters. They're tricksters. They're not really predators who want to come in and take over the Earth and turn it into the Matrix.
Mm-hmm.
And then they, you know, if they did that, they wouldn't even have any satisfaction. They'd probably just go on and do something else somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
They are tricksters, and their fascination is with our minds. It's a mind game. It's a battle in the mind.
Mm.
It's a cosmic test. You know, I have an article on the site in which I draw more than 12 exact parallels between the Archons and the so-called flyers that are described in the work of Carlos Castaneda.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the last book of Castaneda, called The Active Side of Infinity, was published just after he died.
Okay.
And many people may not have read that last book of Castaneda, but I tell you, it's absolutely remarkable because it deals completely with this subject, with predators and psychic invasion. That's the subject of that book.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he calls these predator entities the flyers. And he describes them in many ways that are exactly parallel to what the Gnostics say. And at one point, Castaneda is having a conversation with Don Juan. And I would add, by the way, it doesn't matter if you believe if this is made up or not.
Sure, sure.
Because the truth comes in fictional form and in factual form.
I believe so, yeah.
So Castaneda is having this conversation with Don Juan, who says to him, and he's a very ancient old shaman who can detect these beings, and Don Juan says, they're the way that the universe tests us to see if we can master our own minds. And I believe that that's the final statement about the Archons. It's a test. They are tricksters. They're malicious tricksters. But they don't really have any grand plan or any grand scheme behind it. They just like to fuck with our minds.
So, I mean, within the framework of the universe, one you know, questions, but what is their purpose then? But
they don't have a purpose.
But I think that they do. I mean, if they kind of represents a kind of a breakdown aspect to you know, what the universe creates and so forth, this is a way for the universe to make something stronger or better or more efficient or what have you. If we look at nature, these things happen all the time. There's a a cycle of death, so to speak, winter, and then we have the summer or spring, you know, when things grow. But it's a necessary process in order for the you know, continuation of the universe. So in effect, they do feel a purpose to kind of, you know, if we compare it to how bacteria and antibodies work or whatnot, would you say that that might be, you know, the reason for them, so to speak?
I agree with you, and I follow you on that. When I say they don't have a purpose, what I mean is that they in themselves don't have a designated aim for their activity.
Right, right.
Yet, you are absolutely correct. The nature of the activity and the way that it affects our species has a purpose in the great scheme of things.
Hmm.
I believe that they are tricksters from beyond the earth who invade our minds and who test us, and that we must face the Archons. And I've faced them many times, and many people have met them. But unfortunately, in the UFO ET literature, there's not enough information about how to resist these beings, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they can be resisted. And in fact, the Gnostic teachings contain explicit information about how to resist them and repel them.
Hmm, really, no?
Yes, Kundalini and the Alien Force.
Hmm, fascinating.
Is perhaps the most important essay on this subject in MetaHistory.org.
Ah.
Kundalini and the Alien Force describes, cites Gnostic documents and describes techniques used to repel these mind parasites. So there is a game going on here. There is a test involved, and it's a cosmic test. And you are absolutely right. It falls into the general plan of evolution that that we would be tested in this way.
And those who kind of succumb, I guess, to their trickery, is that a way? And this is going to sound horrible, but who knows what the construct of the universe is? Things die all the time. What I'm getting at is this a way for the universe to actually, you know, clean off some of the, how should I put it? So, you know, a consciousness that hasn't taken control of itself, so to speak, meaning that they can't fight out these forces, and this is a way for the creation to advance, you know, through generations, so the consciousness actually becomes more efficient, stronger, better, more, you know, independent, whatnot. Do you think that could be the case?
In my view, my friend, that is exactly the case.
Mm.
And I couldn't say it better myself. You know, I was having some one time, which I was having a doing some explorations in heightened awareness, put it in that way, and I was practicing some shamanism, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
And when I practice shamanism, I do it with specific intention. I just don't do it recreationally, you know. I sit around and look at hallucinations.
Understand.
But I ask questions and I pursue things. And in one particular session, I asked a question about the Archons. I asked what was their purpose in the scheme of the Earth. And the answer I got was exactly what you just said. They're here to clean out the part of our species that cannot take responsibility for its own mind.
Hmm.
Because, see, mind is our gift. The Gnostics called it nous, N-O-U-S, and they taught that our intelligence is a spark of divinity, that we have a spark of divine intelligence in us, nous.
Mm.
And that what makes our species unique and what makes it novel and allows us to play and invent and create and innovate is that we have this divine intelligence. But it's being tested. And in those members of our species that it's not mastered will be sheared away.
Mm.
And the Archons are, in a sense, the tool for shearing away a part of the human species.
Hmm. Hmm. Yeah. And that's, as I said, that is kind of, well, I don't know. I mean,
it's very scary.
Yeah.
But I think it's true.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there is a reason why there are, you know, so many philosophies around. The humanity as such is still, you know, pondering what the purpose of everything is, obviously. And
that's right.
And we can't, you know, in front of that, we can't say, no, the universe isn't that brutal. In a way, it actually goes back to the idea that we talked about earlier, that if it is the case that a creator God needs a sacrifice, how, again, mm-hmm. can we question that, you know, can we question that idea, meaning that we might not be in a position right now to understand why that is a necessary act or whatever for the universe to sustain itself.
Mm-hmm.
Any ideas?
Well, in this case, I think it's an elegant solution. You know, by the way, it's Sophia's solution. Sophia is my name taken from the Gnostic myth for Gaia, for the intelligence of the earth. She is the hostess with the mostess, as we say in the States. She is the planet on which we live, and she is also the responsible for the creation of the archons. She produced the archons, and if you want to learn about how that happens, you have to read the Gnostic creation myth.
Mm.
But as I understand Sophia, has great faith in human intelligence. She believes in the particular gift of our species and celebrates it. And yet she also gives our species the option to eliminate itself.
Yeah, well,
we can eliminate ourselves.
That's freedom.
And we're doing a fantastic job of it, if you ask me. Not only because of the pollution that we've created out of our ignorance, because we haven't corrected our mistakes, remember, haven't corrected our errors. It was an error to create the internal combustion machine without first solving the problem of the pollution that it would cause. That was an error.
Well, I actually don't agree with you there. I see that is a perfect way for us during that particular time in history when that technology became available, when the discovery of oil in that sense was made. Mm-hmm. But what I do see as a faulty thing, though, is that our lack of moving on from there right now.
Right.
I mean, there are so many technologies available, and on one, I mean, I'm kind of jumping between the both of these sides, so to speak. I don't know if you have a more cautious mindset towards technology and the development of it. I see it more that it is, you know, beneficial to our development, and the reason for that we are involved in it is because we actually are creators in a sense ourselves, and we want to create and improve our environment or whatnot. But again, obviously, this can always be used at a negative usage, and we can, you know, as a consequence of that. And you're right there that we are destroying.
Well, I don't have any objection to that view at all. In fact, I like what you said.
Sure.
Very much. In the time and setting that it was invented, the combustion engine was internal combustion engine was an appropriate invention for us. And the problem is that we didn't move on and improve it.
Exactly. Yeah.
We stayed with the model that we invented in the first place, even when we knew that it had very bad side effects.
Well, and then we have people, you know, adding lead to the gasoline that wasn't necessary from to begin with, you know,
right.
The diesel engine from you know, the German guy, I think, diesel, that was, you know, even more environmentally friendly than the stuff we use today, basically, you know.
Right. That's right. So I agree with you on that. I think that I do have a very cautious view, obviously, of technology. I'm not exactly a technophobic person,
sure.
But I have a very cautious view, and my strongest objection to technology is that I am concerned about the technology that would lead us in this archontic direction. A lot of the hype about the new technology in bionics and artificial intelligence, I think, is quite dangerous.
And
probably delusional. Marshall McLuhan, who was this guy who was kind of a pop guru back in the 60s, warned way back then about the danger of a prosthetic device, you know?
Mm.
Prosthetic device is like if your teeth fall out, you get false teeth, right?
Mm, sure.
And or if your arm is cut off, you get an artificial arm put on. But he warned that we would adopt prosthetic devices that we don't even need, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's like, why, if I have a perfectly good set of teeth, why would I want to put false teeth on my teeth, you know? But I think that's what quite a bit of this new technology is proposing,
sure.
Especially this technology that's leading in the direction of, you know, the immortality fantasies, which you get into quite a bit on your site, I notice, and I'm interested in how you view that and how you're going to handle that subject, because I've also written quite a lot about that.
I do want to give a tip later on in regards to a short film that we did that really goes in a little bit and ask a little bit of questions about this idea of longevity in connection to the Archons. And one thing that we did in this short film was to, and I don't know if you read this article or not, but those who are involved right now in the Human Genome Project, one mainly Craig Venter is one of the
Craig
guys.
Craig Venter, right.
Very prominent right now.
Yeah.
And he was, of course, involved in this project set out to first map the human genome, but now
right.
they set up a new contest that actually is about mapping the DNA of what they call it high-speed sequencing of mapping the DNA of multiple persons, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an X Prize, by the way. And the interesting thing here is that they named the contest the Archons a Genomics X Prize Contest.
Did they?
Yeah. So I mean,
wow,
what the heck is going on there, eh?
Well, you know, this immortality idea is a central theme of the Abrahamic religions. Did you know that?
Well, come again, say that again.
The immortality idea,
uh-huh.
The idea that you could have an immortal physical body,
mm.
deathless, is part of the Abrahamic religions.
Well, again, that's why a guy like Aubrey de Grey, we touched upon this in our short film too, he names his foundation that is into longevity research, the Methuselah Foundation, that is derived directly from the Bible, from the oldest person in the Bible, actually.
Right, but it's not quite the right name. That's not the figure, that's not the actual figure in the Bible who represents immortality.
Really? Okay.
Methuselah represents longevity.
Right, right.
But not immortality.
Sure, okay. Mm-hmm.
Immortality is represented by another being called Melchizedek.
Uh-huh, okay.
And Melchizedek is the whole foundation. Melchizedek is the being who founded the whole Abrahamic religion and Christianity and Judaism.
Okay. Huh. According.
And Melchizedek mm-hmm. is described in the Bible as being without age, without parents, and without generation.
Hmm.
Meaning that he was not born in a natural way, generation being biological reproduction, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, this description of Melchizedek, which occurs in Romans in the New Testament, is absolutely startling because it's a description of a cloned human being who can live forever.
Sheesh, really?
Yes.
God.
And that figure, that idea, and that figure are present at the core of these religions. And all of the people who adhere to these religions believe, you know, that in one form or another, well, after death, they will be, if they do what the Father God wants and they're
mm-hmm.
obedient,
mm-hmm.
After death, they will be resurrected and given an immortal body.
Hmm. Yeah, I see what you mean. So that, and even the idea of, you know, at the end of days, everyone will rise again from the grave, basically. You
That's
know?
Right.
Huh.
That's right. And so this concept that Ventnor and these other people are working toward, or the transhumanists, you've heard
sure.
of them, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
These people who are proposing that through artificial intelligence and genomics we can create an immortal human being are actually working out an ancient religious belief system.
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah?
If we look at the terminology used and even the symbolism in some cases, the usage of the grail, for instance, have been kind of, you know, again, connected with the longevity theme.
That's right.
There's so many things there. So the question obviously becomes, at this point, the people that are involved in this, are they then influenced by the Archons on a, you know, unconscious level, that they're being affected, or are they consciously, you know, driving this because of their own, you know, ego or interest or that they themselves actually are involved in some very, you know, occult, basically, mythology, you know?
Well, if I wanted to be, you know, very cautious about it, Henrik, I would say, well, they're probably just, you know, scientists with big egos who, are, you know, who want to make a big score, okay?
Mm, sure.
But if we want to look a little, scratch the surface and look a little deeper, I have to tell you that I wouldn't be at all surprised if these characters are involved in some level of occultism, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if the Archon influence is not what's really driving them, if they are not, have become archontically deviated. It's
mm-hmm.
a deviation
mm-hmm.
Away from humanity toward a kind of mutation of the human species.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's either going to be one thing or the other. Either we're going to reach that mutation, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Science will reach those goals, or we won't. And if we don't reach them, we may end up wiping ourselves out in the meantime, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much how it looks to me.
Well, that's pretty scary. I mean, one thing is, of course, what is the option here? I kind of look at all of this as a way to, I say that we need to take the good parts of every little piece, you know, that we have, and
mm-hmm.
and make sure to move on. That's the most important thing, that we actually don't stop in our tracks in that sense, that we continue to evolve and you know, again, consciously evolve, not just, you know, flying off on some other, you know, weird path of some you know, interests of one single person or whatnot. But I mean, many people see that the option at this point is to, no, we need to, you know, totally dismantle everything we got and go back, you know, go back to the ancient times, go back to you know, a pagan religion and so forth, and
right.
That's the best thing. What do you see as an option at this point that we can do, you know?
Well, first of all, I want to say that what you're expressing here is what I call the heroic attitude, you know. Joseph Campbell, who was a great mythologist, and some people consider me to be his successor,
mm-hmm.
Wrote a book called The Hero with a Thousand Faces,
mm-hmm.
and I also wrote a book called The Hero. And what you're expressing is the heroic attitude, the warrior attitude, that is that we face a perhaps incomprehensible situation, and we face impossible odds, but we try to turn that into something good.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So you're asking me, well, what good option can we make out of this? Well, that's a fucking great question, you know? I don't believe, by the way, I'm obviously a pagan and a mystic, but I don't believe that we would go back to ancient paganism. I believe that we might go to some kind of future paganism.
Hmm.
But specifically on this subject of genomes and creating the immortal human being, it's hard to say, you know? I guess I would say that the option for me would be this. Rather than thinking about how I could mutate into an immortal human being, I would like to know what is the absolute most I can get out of my mortal physical body.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm.
What is the most bliss I can experience? What is the most pleasure? What is the highest intensity of feeling and perception that I can have in this mortal body? I guess that would be my option. I guess I would say, well, I would like to see what's the most I can get out of that. And then maybe if I'm not satisfied with that, we could consider mutating into some other form.
Mm.
No?
Mm.
So I guess that would be my response. I'm really into the body.
Sure, absolutely. Well,
yeah.
You know, what about the idea that, you know, I've been pondering on that idea of where we're heading right now, and again, I can see that there's very, you know, very, you know, good purpose, so to speak, with all the connectivity that is going on. I say the internet is a kind of basically a representation of the neural pathways of, you know, Gaia, basically, that
right.
all these little cells running around, human beings then are, you know, connected to each other, and that's wonderful and all of that. But then on the other side, you have the danger of that, you know, the microchipped population with the computer, you know, interface, you know, everyone hooking up to the same illusion, and then we're basically going to go just deeper into the matrix, and we actually are going to lose our individuality and our own consciousness in that process. So
well, you describe it beautifully. I mean, you describe the I think that's really the great challenge that we face. That is the challenge of globalization.
Yeah.
And you describe both the positive side of it and the negative side of it, you know.
Mm.
And boy, I don't pretend to have the answer to that. I don't have the answer to a lot of things, you know. But I'll tell you what my sense is. My sense is that, you know, there used to be in the States, we used to have this bumper sticker. Because, you know, people in the United States express the most profound philosophies on the back of their cars. You know?
Right.
And the bumper sticker said, think globally, act locally.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
So my observation would be this, that no matter how much positive globalization we have, you know, no matter how much we become neurally connected across the planet, like mm-hmm. you and I are being connected by internet radio.
Sure.
You have to live locally. You don't live on the earth. You live in a place on the earth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You have to live locally. And as long, you know, there's a name for this. It's called bioregionalism.
Mm-hmm.
Bioregionalism is a term which means that the people who live in a place have a profound relationship to the place they live.
Right.
And so I think as long as we can maintain bioregionalism, and as long as people live locally, which means grow their own food locally, understand where their water comes from locally, understand the nature or immediately around where they live, then I think that's the grounding we need to not be driven out of our minds by globalization.
Yeah, I believe you're right on there. I'm kind of looking at that too as a kind of, you know, some of the solution. The question though is that arises obviously is our local or are our local kind of surroundings changing because of you know, climate change? Things are obviously going on. I mean, there's no doubt of that. And could we end up in a situation where we actually cannot longer, you know, sustain things as they are on the planet? Do you think that's a possible danger here?
I think that it's probable that it's going in that direction. Certainly, the local impact of certain global changes is obvious to me. I could give you many examples. The way animals are behaving, the way the seasons come 6 weeks earlier than normal.
Or no season at all.
Or no season at all.
Yeah.
You know, I think we are going to face that, and I think that's going to be one of the challenges to our adaptation, you see.
Mm-hmm.
But here again, we get back to the archontic question. You know, it's like saying, well, if we're going to be facing now global warming and meltdown of the Greenland ice shelf and all kinds, if we're going to be facing changes in the biosphere, how are we as a species going to face these changes in the biosphere if we're totally absorbed in artificial reality?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we have become so archontic that all we can do is relate to our machines and our iPods and our computers and all these devices and gimmicks that we have, how the hell are we ever going to face the crisis in our natural environment, you know?
Yeah.
I think we're really coming to, we're in that crisis. We're not coming to it. We are in it. We're in it.
Mm.
Yeah. And it's the generation of the people who are in their 20s and 30s now who really have to be smart and have a lot of courage to face this.
Yeah. And then we have the idea of conflicting information constantly. There are different reports coming out that the ice sheet, for example, aren't actually melting. There are actually rebuilds up in other places. We have
we have
philosophers that propose that added carbon dioxide to the atmosphere actually might be a very good thing because plants and so forth, you know, harvest they live on that basically, you know. We could have consequently more rain because of that. We might actually moving into a whole new era of the planet, meaning the era where the planet becomes more, you know, gives more, so to speak, more growth and more, you know, the desert, you know, begin to disappear and so forth. But a consequence of that, meaning that if we try to stop this now with removing carbon monoxide, that's the consequence of that is that we're going to live, you know, in a worse environment. I don't know.
That's right.
Any ideas?
It's crazy making. We don't really know. But whichever of those scenarios is true, the fact remains that we're going to have to adapt to changes in the environment. And if we make ourselves too dependent on our technology, we are going to be less able to make that adaptation. You see, that's my point again. You know, technology has that danger. We become dependent on our toys and our devices. And a species that's dependent on its toys and devices, when it has to get out there like the beavers and the birds and the whales and deal with the changes in the environment is going to be wiped out in 10 years.
Yeah.
So it's all about getting back to nature. Sounds very corny, but that's what it is about. And that's what my message is about, sacred ecology.
Sure.
And I believe that the Gnostics were profound mystics and shamans who looked deeply into the processes of nature and understood nature in an intimate way, and I think that we would benefit from following their example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we are actually moving in. The consciousness is beginning to, go back to that idea. In many cases, not, again, this is not across the board of how overall humanity behaves or whatnot. But if we don't learn of it, I think we're going to have to be forced to learn the hard way. And I hate to go down that road, you know.
That's right. And as far as the learning process is concerned, how does our species learn to cooperate with nature, to become symbiotic, and to make the best of the natural environment, that is, to be in harmony with Gaia, if you want to put it that way?
Right.
Well, that's where entheogens come in. And that's why MetaHistory.org, although it may not appear so at first sight, is one of the most powerful entheogenic sites on the Internet, as far as I know. My intention, anyway, is to send a very strong message about entheogens or sacred plants, or what I want to call medicine plants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we now know that of all the millions, first of all, plants are the most prolific species on the Earth.
Right.
There are more plants than any other species, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we know that of the millions, of the hundreds of thousands of plant species, there are about 200 of those that have a very special nature. That is, that when we ingest them, they enhance the operations of our brain because they have neurotransmitting chemicals in them.
Mm.
And this has only been known, recently. I mean, it's been known by shamans for thousands of years, but science has only known recently that there are about 200 kinds of plants, including psychedelic mushrooms, psilocybin mushrooms, ayahuasca, iboga, things like that.
Right.
That have psychomimetic properties. They don't impose anything on our psyche. They just crank up the operation of the mind and the psyche to an extraordinary level.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that those plants, the entheogens, have been provided by Gaia to teach us how to follow her designs and how to live and survive over the long term.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they are so important, and that's why entheogens are such a central message in my work.
Mm. Oh, wonderful. And that's, I guess, also why many, controlling agents of this planet now are trying to make plants
illegal. To eat fresh mushrooms.
Sure, yeah, exactly.
Do you know that there is a toad? Do you know about toad licking?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, there's bufotenic acid on toads.
Right.
And if you lick the toad, you can get you can go into an altered state, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It is known in the United States, this is going to blow you away, it's known in the United States that the Colorado River toad, which lives in the area of the Colorado River, it's quite rare, is highly hallucinogenic. It's if you lick the back of that toad, you will get high. You will go into an altered state. Well,
right.
It is now illegal to own a Colorado River toad.
There we go. Nice. Oh, my God. Well, wait, you just hold on there, because they're going to genetically modify that toads. So we don't even have to worry about that, eventually.
Oh, they're going to make a better toad out of that toad.
Of course.
Yeah, and in Amsterdam, where I frequently used to go to the smart shops to buy dried mushrooms, well, then dried mushrooms were made illegal and put on the same level as Class A drug cocaine, which is totally insane.
Hmm.
There is no clinical evidence and scientific evidence that psychedelic mushrooms produce damage on the level of cocaine or alcohol.
Hmm.
None whatsoever.
Hmm.
Now, they're banning fresh mushrooms.
Really?
Yeah, they are. They're making it illegal to sell fresh mushrooms in Holland now.
They do? Okay.
And you are absolutely right. You see, the one greatest threat to the authorities, and this is what I'm writing about right now on the MetaHistory site, this is my current material, my current project,
mm-hmm.
The one greatest threat to the authorities is that we should have free access to the plants nature gives us to enlighten us.
Right.
Because then we will be onto the game, then we will see we're being controlled, deceived, and manipulated. And so these plants, which just grow in nature, are going to be systematically forbidden to us.
Mm.
And there is a battle. There is a battle taking place there.
John, we would love to have you back on the program here at some point, and maybe we could. This would be a perfect topic actually to dive in further into the entheogens and see, what is good, what is not, and so forth, and explore that a little while.
I would be delighted to do that, Henrik. And also, it gives me the opportunity to speak about those things in a way that is sober and clear and well balanced.
Exactly.
Because I think that it's an extremely important subject, and it should not be discussed in a fanatical or imbalanced way.
Right.
And I'd love the opportunity to go into it with you.
Excellent.
When that's appropriate.
Yeah, perfect. You know, again, I want to thank you so much for a fantastic interview. This has been a fabulous program. Awesome. And I want to leave the last few minutes here again to you so you can mention your website again, your latest book, but also mention the earlier books that you have out there. I'm not familiar with too many of them. Mention them for us.
Well, my first book was called The Seeker's Handbook. It came out in 1991, and it's kind of a general guide to alternative spirituality. After that, I wrote two books on comparative mythology. One is called Twins and the Double, and the other one is called The Hero. Then I wrote, in 1999, my main work on the star zodiac and the constellations of the sky, which is called Quest for the Zodiac. And my most recent book is this book on Gnosticism, which is called Not in His Image. That came out in November of 2006. I just want to mention, too, Henrik, that in addition to the metahistory.org site, there's a sister site called futureprimitive.org, which you can get to from the homepage of Metahistory. And it has interviews. It's all interviews with fantastic people. And there are some interviews with me on there regarding the subjects we've been discussing.
Nice. Excellent. So metahistory.org and
futureprimitive.org.
Okay, excellent. Again, John, thank you so much for coming on. A true pleasure having you on.
Thank you so much, and we'll continue to be in touch. It's been a real pleasure.